It's Tuesday, January 9, 2018. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Today we'll see the persistence of truth in an age of untruth. We'll ask, is the truth really more important than ever before? We'll see the cultural rift between California and Washington, D.C. We'll look at the battle for our eyeballs in modern television programming, and we'll ask what we can learn from those constant drug ads. The most noteworthy aspect of yesterday's edition of the New York Times wasn't a news story. It was an advertisement, an ad placed by the New York Times, about the New York Times, about truth. Yesterday's edition included a full page with these few words. The truth has power. The truth will not be threatened. The truth has a voice. At the bottom of the page, the simple iconic masthead, the New York Times. But just the day before, in Sunday's edition of the paper, timed for that evening's Golden Globes Awards program, the New York Times, on the first of these pages, had the words, he said, she said, he said, she said, he said, she said, and then 144 more times, an unbroken, she said. Very clearly was the New York Times signaling its own virtue, associating with the hashtag MeToo campaign and the political messaging sent at the Golden Globes concerning the issues of sexual harassment. It was a pretty unnuanced message. Again, he said, she said, he said, she said, he said, and then 145 times, she said. The second full page in the New York Times, about the New York Times, simply had the words, the truth has a voice. At the bottom of the page, again, the iconic masthead of the New York Times. Now, it's really clear what's going on here. The New York Times is signaling, by means of these ads, that it is the authoritative voice for truth in the culture, that it cares deeply about truth, that it, perhaps alone, is committed to finding the truth and giving the truth a voice. This follows last year's first effort in this series by the New York Times. That time, it was scheduled to coincide with the Academy Awards presentation. The messaging back then, in 2017, I quote, "The truth is hard. The truth is hard to know. The truth is more important than ever," end quote. That last line is the most important of the claims made by the New York Times, and in accordance with this particular advertising campaign, it actually draped those words around its building. The truth is more important than ever, claims the Times. Well, before looking further and more deeply at the issue of truth in our contemporary moment, it is really important for us to recognize that from a biblical perspective, it simply is not true that the truth has never been more important. It is true to say that it's never been more important and it's never been less important. For Christians, according to a biblical worldview, truth is always the paramount question. It has never been less important. It's actually a fairly ludicrous claim on the part of the New York Times. Are they really suggesting that, going back to that paper's own history, if you look at the last decades of the 19th century, the truth wasn't so important? When you look at two cataclysmic world wars during the 20th century, the truth wasn't so important. When you look at the Depression, the Cold War, and everything that followed, the truth was less important then than it is now. Of course, that's not a serious claim that they would make. It is, however, the background impulse to their current advertising campaign. We know what's going on here. It's very similar to the kind of campaign and posturing undertaken by the major newspaper in the nation's capital, the Washington Post. Just several months ago, that paper began printing under its own masthead the words, "Democracy dies in darkness." In both cases, you have two major newspapers, two of the most influential newspapers in the world, claiming their priority in terms of the business of truth-telling, and, in the words of the Washington Post, implicitly, saving democracy. Saving democracy from what or from whom? Defending truth against what? Well, of course, the most immediate challenge that is reflected in these campaigns is what is referred to as fake news. It's the destabilization of the entire truth and information and media universe. But this is where Christians really do need to think a bit more deeply about this than the New York Times and the Washington Post. Is it because we are less invested in truth? No, to the contrary. It is because we are far more invested in truth. It's also because we understand that the New York Times really does pride itself, along with the Washington Post and other major media, in being very concerned about the truth. They have entire journalistic teams of reporters and writers and editors and levels of editors and then publishers and all the rest, all supposedly working together in order to reveal and to report the truth. And of course, when it comes to a story, let's just take a routine story, like a break-in in a neighborhood. If we're looking for a report on that break-in, we want to know the factual answers to who, what, when, and where. Of course, why would help also. But as we're looking at that, we recognize that the very secular reporters and editors and publishers of the news media, they really do believe in the facts. They want to get to those facts when it comes to a break-in in a home. But when it comes to bigger and more complex questions, well, at that point, the editors and the reporters and others tend to mix up their own categories. The New York Times, when they're claiming to be the voice of truth, they're not just speaking about what they take pride in terms of their rather objective reporting about major events. No, they're implying that also about their analysis. They're claiming truth for their own worldview. This is where Christians also have to understand that one of the hallmarks of the modern age as we know it is the denial of certain forms of truth, the existence of objective truth when it comes to morality. And furthermore, when it came to the movement known as postmodernism, the denial of objective truth at all. Now, as we're looking at this, we understand that no society can actually operate in any sane way while denying all objective truth. So what you have in the contemporary world are two rival visions of truth, sometimes in the very same mind. You have a level of objective truth, and that's understood to be, well, to go back to our story about a break-in in a home or the robbery of a store, there are facts, and those facts are merely to be taken as facts. They're facts because they are true, because they correspond with reality. But when it comes to a question of morality, well, there's a second dimension of truth, and that's often hand in hand with the rejection of the fact that there can be any moral facts. There are only moral opinions. The Christian thinker Francis Schaeffer pointed to this in his most important book. That book was written in 1968, the title Escape from Reason. Schaeffer famously argued that in the modern secular mind, there was actually a two-story picture of truth. A lower story that consisted of facts and an upper story that merely contained opinions. The lower story was cognitive, the upper story was non-cognitive. As Schaeffer indicated, the denial of objective truth in matters of morality was the modern age's way of putting all those questions that it wanted to answer in a very different way beyond the cognitive level of facts into the non-cognitive level of mere opinion. So we have to recognize that the modern age has been trying to argue that there are some facts. Those facts are understood to be true, true in the sense that they correspond with reality. In the modern cultural moment, you see this especially affirmed amongst persons who reduce all matters of fact to what's often limited to science, fact-based research, they say. But when it comes to questions of morality, such as whether or not an unborn human life is actually human, whether or not abortion is right or wrong, whether we can know that abortion is either right or wrong as moral facts, well, at that stage, everything simply kicked up into the second story, into a matter of opinion. Then it's just a matter of which opinion gains majority status and support. We need to understand that that is the essence of modern politics and cultural conversation. We need to understand that that is the worldview that drives those identified as the cultural creatives, those who are the producers and the directors and the storytellers in Hollywood and beyond. We need to understand that what Francis Schaeffer warned about as this two-story picture of truth, it is being drilled through every level of the culture. It is being drilled especially through every level of education, particularly higher education, but there is plenty of evidence these days that it is also being drilled down even into kindergarten and grade school in terms of much of the official curriculum. It is encouraging, in one sense, that the New York Times is so interested in truth, even if it comes in the form of a self-advertisement. But when it states that the truth has never been more important, Christians agree with every single word, so long as it's followed by the fact that the truth has never been less important either. For Christians, the truth is not just important, it is ultimate. Next, I turn to looking at that deep cultural divide we see in America. We're not the only ones who see it. The New York Times and others see it as well, sometimes referring to not just one America, but two Americas, speaking of that very deep moral and cultural divide. Recently, the New York Times ran a front-page article by Tim Arango, the headline, "One America Fights Another as Rift Widens." But the subhead's interesting. California pushes back against White House. Now, it's not just California and the White House, but that particular dynamic is the initiating catalyst of the story. It's really about that great worldview divide that separates Americans. And when it comes to the state of California, there's no doubt where the majority of the political leaders in that state stand. Almost all of them are California Democrats. But when it comes to the rest of America, is California now foreign country? Arango writes, quote, "In many ways it feels like that these days, as the growing divide between California and the Trump administration erupted this past week over a dizzying range of flashpoints from immigration to taxes to recreational marijuana use." I think in many ways it's that last issue that has the front place attention here. Last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the federal government would be reversing a few Obama-era executive orders that had indicated that the Department of Justice would not pursue investigations and prosecutions of federal marijuana laws. There are now about 8 states that have legalized recreational marijuana, and the Obama administration had announced that where the states had done so, the feds would not prosecute, even though in all 50 states and in all American territories, the use, the possession, the distribution, and the sale of marijuana remains a federal crime. So you now have a dynamic between those states that have legalized marijuana and the federal government. But what's really interesting is what this shows us about how, in a moral civil war, people, or states for that matter, can change sides and change arguments pretty quickly. Back during the 1950s and the 1960s, it was largely Southern states, using a states' rights argument, who sought to defend segregation laws. And the larger nation, especially, led by those who were ardently anti-segregation, argued that the states had no right to violate federal laws or federal decrees. That was a major dynamic. On the one hand, you had an argument about states' rights. On the other hand, you had a prevailing argument about federal supremacy on such questions. But when it comes to marijuana, all of a sudden, California is singing a very different tune. California has learned to sing the anthem of states' rights over the issue, particularly of legalized marijuana. We have often observed that the closer you get to one of the oceanic coasts, the more liberal the society becomes on many moral and cultural issues. That's true on the East Coast, but particularly in the Northeast, but it is true on the entirety of the West Coast, the United States Pacific Coast. Just consider this political profile. Quote, "In California, every state leader is a Democrat, including the governor and the leaders of the state Senate and the Assembly. Of the state's 53 members in Congress, only 14 are Republicans, and," the article in the Times goes on to say, "analysts believe that several of them are in serious political jeopardy in the 2018 midterm elections." One of the interesting dimensions of this article in the Times is that it identifies a certain impulse in this liberal direction in the state of California and traces it back to the Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He had begun to use the language of California being an almost nation state. And then, as the paper goes on to say, many Californians feel that way. The most important issue for us is to understand that the worldview distinction is real and that eventually it becomes tangible in politics, in laws, legislation, and policies. California knows that. Frankly, we all know that. But what you're looking at in this article is the recognition of a very deep divide that seems only to be getting wider and deeper at the cultural moment. Interestingly, with many other issues also on the table, marijuana has emerged as one of the key issues of contention. leading even a state like California all of a sudden to begin talking about states' rights, reversing the very kind of arguments it had made decades ago. But that really goes both ways when you consider the fact that the current U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was making many of the same arguments in terms of very different issues also a matter of decades ago. What makes the story even more interesting to Christians is our understanding, just as we were discussing on the previous story, that that divide is actually deeper than the secular mind can understand. Meanwhile, as we're thinking about the media programming and advertising, a story in yesterday's edition of the Times indicated that more TV shows are now vying for our eyeballs than at any previous time in history. Last year, John Coblin tells us, there were 487 original scripted programs. That's a record breaker that follows last year's record breaker of 455. Coblin explains, quote, the staggering growth largely comes from the seemingly endless budget lines that help produce new shows for streaming services. Now, one of the things we need to note is that we are looking here at streaming services primarily. The big three producers of scripted programs on television now are FX, HBO, and Netflix. Now, just remember that that's contrasted with what we would have understood even a matter of just a decade ago. Where are CBS and NBC and ABC? Not to mention the major cable networks of yore. But from a Christian perspective, one of the most interesting aspects here is what this underlines in terms of the continued influence of television programming. It's not going away. It's not going away in terms of influence in the culture. It's also not going away in terms of the competition for our eyeballs, because this is where we always need to remind ourselves that programming is not really to entertain us. It is to entertain us in order to send advertising to us. That's what pays the bills. Make no mistake. Hollywood does want to send moral messages in its entertainment, but it can only do so successfully if it gets advertisers to foot the bill. And it's a big bill. We are told in this news article that Netflix is going to spend over $8 billion in terms of production for this programming in just the next 12 months. $8 billion. I also found it interesting to find embedded in this article that just about every one of these individual programs costs on average $3 million. Somebody's got to pay for a lot of advertising to make that commercially worthwhile. Meanwhile, our advertising does reveal a great deal about ourselves. That's why I was drawn to another article, this time in the advertising column of the New York Times. Joanne Kaufman writes that if you think you're seeing more drug ads on television, you actually are. Kaufman tells us that according to Kantar Media, a firm that tracks multimedia advertising, 771,368 drug ads were shown in the last year documented, which is 2016. There's every reason to believe there were more in 2017 and will be more in 2018. That number again, over 770,000 drug ads. She goes on to report, by means of citing John Swallen, quote, TV ad spending by pharmaceutical companies has more than doubled in the past 4 years, making it the second fastest growing category on television during that time. Now, one of the interesting things is what's documented in this article about the shift in these drug ads. It's no longer primarily driven by pharmaceuticals for what would be called minor health problems. It's now for major and massive health problems. Why? Well, the article in the Times argues it is because the television audience is trending older and because we are living longer. And as we do so, more serious health problems represent themselves, and the drug companies are battling amongst themselves in the war for our health. And more urgently for our health dollars. It's also perhaps interesting to note that these health advertisements, drug ads, are directed primarily at television viewers for dramas and news shows. Speaking of the newly more serious drugs addressed in these ads, we are told by Thomas Lahm, a consultant, quote, in the old days, it was allergies and acid reflux and whatnot. Now it's cardiology issues, it's cancer, end quote. Now, if you've been looking at these ads, you're probably thinking what I'm thinking. How would anyone want to take these drugs once they have to tell us what the FDA requires, which is about the potential side effects? Some of them truly horrifying. some potentially clarifying, others, admittedly, mystifying. But one of the interesting dimensions of what's reported in this story is that all of those dreaded side effects the FDA requires to be cited don't seem to have much of an effect upon the impact of the advertising. Part of this is because, authorities say in the article, that drugs that are to have a dramatic effect, well, are understood to sometimes come with dramatic other effects. But there's something else in the article about the confusion that comes with white noise. That is to say, we find ourselves tuning out what we're not really interested to hear. And it tells us something about human nature, that we are more interested to hear the benefits of a drug than what might be the unavoidable side effects. But authorities in the article also say that the advertising might actually appear to be more credible and more truthful if the side effects are listed along with the primary benefit. But that takes us back to where we started, on the issue of truth. It turns out that even a society and a modern age that wants to escape the question of truth simply can't. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can find me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Orlando, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.